Welcome to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. This edition is a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Valerie Steele, one of the fashion industry's most influential women, a high school dropout who eventually received a doctorate in modern European cultural and intellectual history from Yale. Valerie is the director and chief curator of the museum at FIT, New York's Fashion Institute of Technology. She's written or co-written more than a dozen books, has been profiled in print and on television, and is one fascinating, forward-thinking, fantastic mover and shaker who has not only been instrumental in creating the modern field of fashion studies, but in raising public awareness of the cultural and social significance of fashion. This conversation is worth hearing again and again. Enjoy. Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Valerie Steele has been described as one of the fashion industry's most influential women. And why not? She's been instrumental in creating the modern field of fashion studies, as well as raising public awareness of the cultural and social significance of fashion. Steele joined New York's Fashion Institute of Technology as an adjunct professor in 1985. In 1997, she was named the museum's chief curator and became director in 2003. She has organized more than 20 exhibitions, including The Corset, Fashioning the Body, Gothic, Dark Glamour, and the most recent, A Queer History of Fashion, From the Closet to the Catwalk, a multi-author book published by Yale University Press and edited by Valerie, accompanies the exhibition. Speaking of books, Valerie's written or co-written more than a dozen. Her first, Fashion and Eroticism, was published in 1985. Fashion Designers A to Z was released in 2012. She's also the editor-in-chief of the three-volume Encyclopedia of Clothing and Fashion. Steele has been profiled in print and on television, appearing on the PBS special The Way We Wear and The Oprah Winfrey Show. Growing up, Valerie said she wanted to be an actress, and while that involved dressing up, she wasn't sure it could be considered fashion. She went to high school, didn't stay. Bored, she dropped out. Steele did get her GED and wound up at Yale, receiving a doctorate in modern European cultural and intellectual history. Seems corsets were the catalyst that propelled Valerie to combine scholarly fashion history and cultural history, and the rest is history. I am so excited to have you here today
Thank you so much, Valerie.
And I want to begin by saying I'm guessing it's not every day that a school like Yale accepts a high school dropout. Would you talk about that part of your life?
Yes. It's funny. Many years later, someone said to a friend of mine, do you know whatever happened to that girl, Valerie? And she said, yeah, she's getting a PhD at Yale. And the person laughed and said, no, seriously, have any idea what happened to her?
So what did happen? First of all, where did you grow up?
I grew up everywhere from D.C. to Boston, and I ran away when I was 15, so I lived out in a commune in San Francisco, and then I came back east and eventually ended up going to college. I only applied to Ivy League schools, and the only one I got into was Dartmouth, which I hadn't seen before I got there. So I hitchhiked up to go to the first week of classes and thought, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?
Because it was so nowhere?
Well, it was so nowhere. It's like the Mississippi of the North. But also, it was so right-wing and full of all these fraternity boys. But it was okay. You know, within a few days, I'd met everybody who was—
Worth meeting?
Black, yes, black, gay, foreign, female, everyone who was interesting.
And then from there, you applied to Yale?
Yes.
For your graduate studies?
Right.
You left home at 15. Why?
I was bored. I was frustrated. I wasn't getting along with my mother. And I remember I went out to this office of an underground newspaper in San Francisco when I got off the plane. And, you know, they'd been printing articles, prisoners escape, soldiers go AWOL. And so I said, well, I'm here. And they're like, ah, get out of here. You'll get us in trouble.
For sure.
And I was like, some revolutionaries you are. But eventually they put me in touch with a women's commune. It was a kind of gay and feminist commune. And so they let me stay there. And then I got fake ID and a job and so on and so forth.
And this was in the 70s, I assume,
yes.
Right? I guess that's
rather unusual. Your background is really, I guess, formed you as you are who you are because of who you've been.
I suppose that, I mean, that has to be true, right?
That you're a pretty ballsy broad. That's how you would assess yourself, right?
Well, certainly as a teenager, I was fairly fearless.
Well, that's a good way to be. So I would like to move into Yale now, and I want you to explain how corsets turned your life around, especially from somebody who probably didn't wear a bra back then.
Right. I did not wear a bra back then. I remember my mother pleading with me when I went to the doctor saying, "He's an old man." I thought, is he going to have a heart attack if I'm not wearing a bra?
Or this could be the best day of his life, you know. So
I went to Yale to study cultural and intellectual history, and I had no idea that it would be fashion history. I really didn't know. I thought it would be maybe something about the French Revolution. And then we had an assignment the first term to give a presentation about two scholarly articles we'd read. And I honestly don't remember which ones I read, but my life was changed because my classmate, Judy, gave a presentation on two articles from the feminist journal Signs. One, a standard feminist analysis of the Victorian corset as oppressive to women mm-hmm. and deeply unhealthy. And the other one, a kind of revisionist account that said, no, it was sexually liberating. And it was just as though a light bulb went on. And I realized fashion's part of culture. I can do fashion history, which my professors thought was a seriously bad idea.
Frivolous?
Frivolous, in part because the topic seemed to them completely frivolous. And also, if you want to give a kinder spin to it, they probably thought I'd never get a job because no history department would hire someone specializing in that, which was true.
But you forged ahead anyway.
I was convinced that fashion was a perfectly valid field of study. Mm-hmm. And at that point, there were basically two kinds of writing on fashion. There was journalism, and there was a kind of antiquarian costume studies. But fashion hadn't really been integrated into cultural or social history. And so I went ahead and did that. Being a grad student, I thought, oh, corsets have been scooped. You know, someone else is doing it, so it's too late. So I worked more generally on the erotic aspects of Victorian fashion with a big chapter on the corset. And I could not get a job at any normal history department, not a tenure-track job. So I got a million adjunct jobs, including one at FIT, but I also taught fashion history as an adjunct at Cornell, NYU, Parsons, even Columbia one year, but no full-time job. Uh-huh. So I just kept on researching and writing my books, and then I started my magazine, Fashion Theory, the Journal of Dress, Body, and Culture. And then I had the good luck then to be offered a job at the museum at FIT, which was fantastic because then I got a whole new area to play with in terms of working with colleagues on putting on fashion history exhibitions.
Wait a second. I want to go back to you said when you started your magazine. Who were you that you could start a magazine?
I was somebody who had at that point published several books on fashion history. So I did fashion and eroticism. I did Paris fashion. I did women of fashion, et cetera. And I had a fellowship at the Smithsonian, but I was publishing. Mm-hmm. And I was at a conference, and Catherine Earle, who at that point was the publisher of Berg, which was a small English company, asked me to be on the advisory board for her list of books about fashion. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm perfectly willing to do that, but you're a teeny little publisher, and there are very few really good scholarly books on fashion, so you're going to lose out to bigger publishers like Yale for a lot of them. I said, what you really need to do is start a scholarly journal on fashion studies because there are going to be a lot of people who'll have the experience that I did. They'll write an essay and other journals won't be interested in it because it'll be about fashion.
So it was very fashion historically centric or no?
Well, it was not only the history of fashion. It was more generally fashion studies. It was really interdisciplinary and international. So people wrote who were experts in art history, anthropology, Chinese history. We had essays on things from high fashion models today to foot binding in ancient China to tattooing and piercing to, dandies in the 19th century. I mean, right across the board. And it is still in existence, fashion theory. It's actually been expanded. And so that was kind of one of my platforms. I used to keep in, with me a little cartoon from The New Yorker that showed a bank robber escaping and with a pile of cash. And he turns to a passerby and says, "I'm only doing this to support my writing." And I kind of felt
the
like
same
that.
Way.
Because I was doing all of these teaching jobs, and it, some of them were fun, but others had nothing to do with fashion. You know, I taught Plato to NATO at Juilliard for 10 years.
Oh, that's
and
interesting or
so,
weird.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was weird. So, but I kept writing the books, and I kept doing the magazine. And at FIT, anyway, I was teaching in what was then the Museum Studies Department, specializing in costume and textile history. And so then I got a job part-time as coordinator at the museum, coordinator of special projects, and within a few months that turned into chief curator.
So would you say that back then you landed your dream job because you were able to combine all these elements that you loved, history, current fashion, teaching?
It seemed very much like it was the ideal job. And I remember telling an interviewer, "I can't believe I'm getting paid to play with Balenciagas." You know, it was really great to be there in the collection and be able to collaborate with really talented people putting together exhibitions, which is very different from writing an article or a book, but it's a very immediate way that you can present fashion to an audience.
Well, it's also being right there as opposed to teaching this at Columbia or Cornell. I mean, did you have students who were interested?
Oh, the students for the fashion classes were hugely interested.
You had a waiting list, huh?
Absolutely.
Great.
No, people, it was more the professors who didn't think it was a serious topic.
And kind of were dismissive?
But the students definitely wanted it. In fact, a younger colleague of mine was a grad student in the late 90s at Columbia, and she wanted to write her doctoral dissertation on fashion. And her professors, and that was in sociology, which was founding discipline for fashion
studies.
Sure. They said, no, that's not serious. And as it happened, the first issue of Fashion Theory had just come out, and she brought it in and slammed it down on the desk and said, "Look, this is a scholarly journal. That proves it's a valid topic."
So they had to eat their words.
Yes, they let her do it.
You said something, and I wanted to pick up on it. How do you say Victorian age and eroticism in terms of fashion?
Well, there
you think of it being so repressive, even though, you know, there was décolletage, but
well,
more than that.
The myth that the Victorians were, you know, terrified of sexuality and the body is greatly oversimplified.
Mm-hmm.
The Victorians were obsessed with propriety and respectability. And erotic expression in dress was very much conditioned by what's appropriate. So you could have a plunging neckline at a ball
mm-hmm.
when you were in private, surrounded by people of your own class. But if you wore that dress on the street, people would, you know, throw mud at you and insults
because
it was in public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like we may be very sexually liberated and relaxed about our bodies or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
right.
we'll wear a bikini to the beach, but we certainly won't wear it to the office. Well, magnify that to 10. The Victorians were super conscious of who you were, where you were, what you could or couldn't wear.
Did it matter what you looked like in the Victorian age? I mean, were they as obsessed as we are about body image?
Yes, this is something which is continued. It's part of, I think, women's
cross to bear, as far
yes,
as I'm
cross to bear,
concerned.
A dependent position that so much of their future had to rely on how attractive they were, who would marry them, etc. So I remember, but that's continuing today to a considerable extent. I remember my students used to ask, how was it or why was it that the corset was finally abandoned after 400 years? And I used to say, well, you know, it really wasn't abandoned so much as it was internalized as diet and exercise and plastic surgery. The end goal was the same, to have an attractive, youthful figure. But the corset involved pushing your fat around or padding you out, whereas now you're the clothes show more of your body, and so you have to do something more immediately with the body itself. For example, My Secret Life, which was an erotic autobiography, the author says at one point, no man will stay long with a woman whose skinny buttocks he can hold in the palm of one hand. You know, you wanted someone with big butt.
Right,
you
right.
Know, voluptuous bosom.
Right.
But at the same time, you wanted a small waist, small
sure.
hands and feet. So interestingly enough, what anthropologists call the a waist-hip differential remains essentially the same for Victorians, for Twiggy, for Marilyn Monroe.
That your waist should be 10 inches smaller than your hip?
No.
No?
Waist-hip differential.
What does that mean?
It means that the width of your waist should be about 0.7 of the width of your hips. So 7/10 of the size of it.
Okay. That's,
so do the math.
I can't.
But you can figure it out. And what it amounts to is even Twiggy with small breasts or Marilyn Monroe with a more voluptuous figure, et cetera, they all had essentially the same waist-hip differential.
I see.
So there was that curve out. And it may be hardwired into us because our ancestors would have died out if they'd preferred more like a 0.9 waist-hip differential, which
that
is more
you were
straight up and down, because you would be prepubescent or postmenopausal or beginning to be pregnant. And so the more nubile, young but fertile waist-hip differential is the one that people prefer.
Now, I just thought of this when you said about being pregnant. Not that I'm obsessed with the Victorian era, but what did women do when they were pregnant? Did they dump the corset?
They switched to pregnancy corsets, which expanded. You would unlace it more and more and more. And although obviously if you had to hide it, for example, if you were a servant who'd be fired if she were found to be pregnant, then you would keep tight lacing it to try and repress the swelling in your abdomen, which probably was extremely bad for both mother and fetus. But for most women, you would wear something that would unlace further and further and further. It was really more in the way of right up until the 1960s, many people wore kind of pregnancy girdles.
When you taught at schools as an adjunct, did you have a lot of males in your classes? Did you focus on male fashion, too?
Most fashion classes are predominantly women.
Right.
But sure, we had some men in them. And I think it's important to look at men's and women's fashion together, that if you just look at women's fashion in isolation, you can be misled about certain things.
So make the comparisons.
Corsets entered into the vocabulary of women in about 1500. And at that point, both men and women of the elite wore clothing that was very rigidly structured. And the idea was that you'd be upright and supported and stiff. So if you look at portraits of men as well as women, there's this very much an armored, stiff approach.
Right.
Even in the 19th century, some men wore corsets, particularly things like cavalry officers, because it was thought to give you a trim military figure plus back support for being on horseback.
Okay.
In fact, if you go to a weightlifting room in the gym today, you will still see men wearing what are essentially corsets, those big leather belts which support your back.
Sure.
But the problem was that women's bodies were thought of as being so much weaker than men that they needed to have all the support
they could
all
get
the time. And then it was also a social thing that if you were upper class, you're supposed to be training your body, both for men and women, to be upright, et cetera. Whereas the sort of loose, slovenly body was seen as a lower class phenomenon. And so, of course, working class women already by the 18th century and definitely by the 19th century, when you're mass producing corsets, wanted to assert that they were just as respectable, just as beautiful, just as fashionable as middle and upper class women. So when I did my big corset show, I made a point of getting a rare Victorian man's corset, as well as one of the common at the time but rarely saved working class women's corsets. It was the Pretty Housemaid brand, which was...
That was the actual name of it?
That was the name
of it. Oh, wow. Pretty Housemaid.
It was advertised as being the cheapest and strongest corset made. So you could be down on your hands and knees scrubbing the floor. And the bones, which, of course, were not whale bones. That was way too expensive for a working-class corset. They were metal bones, would not break and puncture your side.
I'd like to move into the idea of models and fashion. As you talk about voluptuousness back then, and now, well, it's not a new theory, but this image of thin and not having really any curves. I mean, that's still with us in 2013. Doesn't that blow your mind a little bit?
It does. It's not really true.
It's not?
No. You had models who had very little in the way of breasts in the 60s and 70s. But you also have very skinny male models then, too. Both boys and both younger, skinnier boys and girls were in fashion. Subsequently, though, in the 80s and early 90s, you had real glamazon models, people like Naomi Campbell and so on, who were had quite pronounced breasts. Subsequently, we've also seen much more in the way of pronounced hips and bottoms. What really distinguishes models is they are, tend to be very young, very tall, and they're a small dress size for that the
right.
waist. But they tend, they do have breasts. They don't have D-cup breasts, but they definitely do have curves.
But for someone like me growing up, these were totally unrelatable females. Nobody spoke to me. They just didn't talk to me. And you really, you know, that you're an impressionable young woman. You really feel bad about that.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. A lot of people blame models and blame fashion for things like anorexia. And I think it's oversimplified. What we know about anorexia has to do with very much trying to struggle against an overly controlling home environment. There are a lot of factors that go into it that long precede sort of fashion industry and fashion publications. There were anorexic nuns in the Middle Ages and anorexic women and girls, and long before fashion got skinny. Back in the voluptuous Victorian period, they were also anorexics. I think that self-image is a very complicated thing, and although people certainly do look at models, particularly teenage girls, I think they look much more at each other than they do at the kind of artificial images. If you're in the fashion world, you see models, and models are kind of like another species. They're men, women, and they're fashion models.
That's a very good way to put
they
it.
They really
That's
are
right.
another species.
And are now, they an anomaly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're genetically blessed, especially for during their brief lifespan as a model which is usually between about 15 and 23. So they're very, very young and tall and, you know, relatively slim compared to the regular population. And they have sort of symmetrical features. It's like another species. It's like saying, oh, I'm jealous of giraffes. I want to be like a giraffe. In fact, many fashion magazines tend to put actresses and singers on the cover now because people identify more with them than with the models per se.
Well, who determined what a model should look like?
Well, that's something which we tend to determine all together as a culture. Fashion is not something that's a monster or a dictator that's imposed by a small number of people. It's something that designers and editors and other, you know, so retailers will propose things. They'll say, well, we have one of these looks we think might catch on this year. But then it's really up to the public what they're going to decide. They'll choose which magazine to buy based largely who's on the cover. They'll choose which clothes to buy. So it's really a collective production. And although we might say that we want to have more diversity, and I think many people, many of us do want more diversity in terms of body type and racial type because runway models are overwhelmingly white.
And why is that?
I feel that that's a real mistake on the part of members of the industry in terms of what they think is going to catch on with the levels of audiences that they have. I think a lot of designers want the models, in a sense, to be just like coat hangers, to kind of disappear. So that you really don't pay much attention to them. You just see the clothes.
Okay.
Because they all sort of look the same now. For a brief period in the '60s and '70s, you had models of different races and different looks, sort of much more personality going down the runway. Now it's sort of they tend to be all tall, white teenagers. And I think it does an injustice, actually, to the fact that more people would be more responsive to different kinds of beauty.
I agree. I also think it doesn't do much for models who become, on some level, just invisible. They're really mannequins, in a sense.
Yes, it's harder to be a supermodel nowadays than it was when you could have more personality.
If given the opportunity, I don't think I'd want to be a model. I think you work really hard and that you're invisible, and nobody kind of gives a damn what you have to say. Just stand there and look attractive or look thin.
We can all hope, I think, that there'll be, again, more diversity in that. I was just at the Paris shows, and Rick Owens' show was really exciting, in part because instead of all the tall white teenagers, he brought in a group of women, most of whom were black, who were college students and young women in their 20s, African-American women, all different shapes and sizes, had to make the clothes specially for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of just walking blandly down the catwalk and back again, they came out doing a performance of stepping.
Wow.
And it was...
So that was a showstopper.
It was a showstopper. It was absolutely an amazing, amazing show. And one of the most exciting things about it was a real demonstration, not only that his clothes you could move in, but the point really was there were all kinds of different beauty and not just the stereotype.
Now, are we supposed to say, isn't he wonderful that he finally got it in 2013?
It's something that a lot of people have been demanding, and it's amazing that we're not seeing more of it. And I think he kind of threw the gauntlet down and said...
Challenged
people. Say, you know, having just one black model in the whole show isn't really enough.
Right. I want to talk also now about your exhibit, Queer History of Fashion.
Yeah.
So queer studies began to promote the idea that fashion could be a form of self-expression,
yes.
Right? And so connect that to the exhibit at FIT.
Right.
And what sparked that, and is it a long time coming?
My colleague, senior curator Fred Dennis, had the idea for the exhibition. He and I were going out to lunch, and we're crossing 7th Avenue, and just talking about ideas for future shows. And he said, wouldn't it be cool to do a show about gays and fashion? And I said, yes, eureka. And nobody had really done this.
But everybody just assumes fashion is full of gay men.
Of course. The assumption is there. But apart from some chit-chat on the internet about who's gay or who's not, there have been a few small shows at LGBTQ centers
mm-hmm.
around the country,
mm-hmm.
mostly with contemporary fashion. And there have been one show that we finally found in Switzerland, which was called Gay Chic, about images of gays and fashion, but not so much clothes. Gays and lesbians have been left out of so much of history, kind of forgotten.
Ignored,
exactly. And oddly enough, they've been left out of fashion history. As a kind of, everyone knows there's lots of gay designers around, there's Marc Jacobs, etc. But no one really thought, well, how long has that been going on? And if you put fashion history together with queer studies and with history of sexuality, suddenly you started realizing that gays and lesbians, bisexual, transgender people have been interested in fashion for a very long time and have been creating styles that were kind of gay vernacular styles.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd also been having an influence on the fashion industry for a long time. We thought at first we'd just do a 20th century show. But the more research we did, we found went back to Oscar Wilde and beyond. It went all the way back to the 18th century, where there have always been people who had same-sex love and same-sex relations
right.
throughout world history, ancient
right.
Greece, ancient China, everywhere. But a lot of scholars of history of sexuality feel that the first kind of quasi-modern gay subculture occurred in the 18th century in northern European cities like London and Paris, big cities,
uh-huh.
economically advanced cities. And in these cities, there started to be groups of quote-unquote effeminate sodomites who would not only hang out together, as they did in Renaissance Florence, for example, but would also start to be creating their own culture. Because in Renaissance Florence or ancient Greece, gay people wore the same clothes that other men of their age did.
Okay.
Age and class. Whereas in the 18th century, you start to find some gay men who are of different classes, not just elite, powerful men, experimenting with cross-dressing in private. They don't want to be executed and arrested. And experimenting with adapting the clothing of aristocratic men, so more elaborate clothes, which start to be redefined as effeminate
mm-hmm.
because the wrong people now are wearing them, and also starting to become interested in making women's clothes.
That interest started when?
You start to find evidence of it in the 18th century.
So before that, men were not really designing women's clothing?
We just don't know.
Okay.
You know, we'll know that one man created a beautiful dress at the court of Louis XIV because Madame de Sévigné talks about it in her letters. We have no idea what sexuality he was. But finally, in the 18th century, you start to get more and more press and police reports about, quote, a fraternity of pretty gentlemen united by mutual love who are interested in creating women's ladies' dresses.
That doesn't seem that pejorative to be described that way.
No. It's a kind of circling around
the issue.
The issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we did a lot of research. We set up a big advisory board with lots of scholars and as well as gay designers and others to help us figure out what we shouldn't forget, you know. And then we went out and tried to find as many of the clothes as we could. You know, one scholar, George Chauncey, who wrote the famous book Gay New York, proving how New York had been a center of gay life, you know, since the 19th century. He suggested, oh, you should get an outfit by the Cockettes, who were a cross-dressing performance group in San Francisco in the 70s.
Yes, I've heard of them.
And we thought, whoa, are any of them still alive? You know, that's sort of what. But we found, we found a Cockette outfit, and we found, you know, early leather gear. And so we were able to put together a show which looks not only at gay men as fashion designers, but also explores lesbian, bisexuals, as designers, as trendsetters, and as creators of vernacular LGBTQ styles, many of which then would influence mainstream fashion.
Were you surprised that there were as many lesbian fashion designers?
You know, it's interesting. Lesbian and bisexual women are much less out than their male counterparts, even today, maybe because it's just tougher being a woman in general in the business. But certainly there's a long history of evidence that lesbians have been interested in fashion and have been involved in it both in terms of creating sort of lesbian elegance, sort of tailored suits and certain hairstyles. But already by the 20s and 30s, lesbians could recognize one another on the street that way. But as well, a number of people in fashion probably were at least bisexual. Way back by the 1930s, back when you start to begin to get evidence of the sexual sexuality, sexual identity of individual players in the fashion world.
Do you think that people might have thought that this exhibit was just basically stating the obvious?
Well, I think that they may have thought that when they came in, but then when they saw how far back it went, people have been absolutely amazed by the 18th and 19th century material. And by the connections about bisexual women in the 30s, like Marlene Dietrich wearing trousers, and this whole kind of gender crossing about people who were known to be gay within their circle, like Noel Coward, but not by the public in general, about how designers like Dior and Balenciaga, Maine Bache, Malineux, Charles James were gay or bisexual. People knew it, but they seldom came out and said anything about it. You know, as one woman said, everyone knew Maine Bache was gay, but nobody said anything. And it was only once in a while where someone like Chanel, who was quite possibly bisexual herself.
But so angry about it, right?
Well, so angry at gay men.
Right, right.
But Chanel was an equal opportunity hater. At different points of her life, she hated anyone that she thought was in her way. She hated her female competitors in the 20s and 30s. But after World War II, when her main competitors were gay men, then she started making very homophobic remarks about Dior and Balenciaga.
Are you not surprised that there aren't more female designers who understand our bodies better than men?
I did a show, I did a book years ago, Women of Fashion, exploring how women worked in the fashion system, to what extent they dominated it or were a minority group in it, to what extent their clothes reflected their gender identity. And it's similar in a way with the issue of gay men. There is an influence, whether you're a woman or a gay man, et cetera, on the clothes often, but not always. And I think it's a subtle one. It has to do with your own attitudes, the period you're living in, the attitudes around there. In the 20s and 30s, because of the rise of sort of independent women, many people just assumed who better to dress a woman than another new woman.
Exactly.
But that hadn't been true prior to that, when the first male designers started coming to the fore, and then later when male designers came to the fore, it seemed, oh, fashion's an art. Maybe, you know, as one male designer put it, fashion's an art and men are the artists.
Hello.
You know, so the different assumptions play out. Women know their own body, but they don't necessarily know other women's bodies any better than men do. It really depends on the individual, their period. Someone like Chanel, it was all about herself, you know, dressing herself and imposing her look on others. Someone like Madeleine Vionnet, didn't really want to dress women who were short and stout like her. Mm-hmm. She wanted to dress women who were tall, who were built well, who moved well, who had the kind of beautiful bodies that she wanted to see in her body-worshipping gowns.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see fashion today? Are you encouraged by the students who are at FIT? Are we in a good place?
The students at FIT are incredibly talented and creative. And the fashion world today is filled with lots of creative people.
So there's room for everybody?
Oh, there should be more and more room for everybody. And I think really it's a question of not waiting and saying, what will fashion do to me? It's a question of reaching out and saying, which part of fashion do I like and that I want to make mine? I really think the idea of a dictatorship of fashion, an empire of fashion, was never really true, and it certainly hasn't been true since the 1970s. It's really broken down from an empire of fashion into a whole lot of different warring style tribes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's all kinds of style tribes which are perfectly appropriate for independent modern women who think they're not interested in fashion. Because let's face it, let's be honest. Your mom doesn't buy your clothes, right? They don't grow in your closet.
No, that's for sure.
You are picking your clothes. You have some interest in presenting a particular image of yourself. So why not be conscious of it and take hold of that and say, this is my look.
And own it.
This is what I like. Own it. Exactly.
So you feel really good about where you are at FIT, where fashion is today?
I find what I do really fun, really interesting. I love my colleagues. I think the students are fabulous. I'm endlessly happy I went into fashion as a field to study. And I think that some of the old feeling that fashion was oppressive to women, in the past there may have been elements of that, although I think women have to also realize that women in the past had more agency than we might think.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just patronize the women of the past as victims. It's like Marx said, men make their own history, but they don't make it just as they please. Women, we've made our own history, women, with fashion. We haven't made it just as we please, with everything free. But within the choices we're offered, we've made decisions on our own. And I think that we have to own what our own relationship is with fashion.
What a perfect way to end.
Thank you.
Valerie Steele, it was really great to meet you. I could have gone on for hours. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Join us for another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. And if you'd like to reach The 51%, contact us at advertising@51%conversations.com. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.